Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and we are still covering the notes on the Constitutional Convention. These are Madison's notes. Now, when we're all done, I'm going to post these up. And it's been taking me a long time to kind of go through these things because I'm creating the navigation pane, and I'm actually using a color code. So most of the stuff that Paul and I covered are in blue, are in, actually in yellow. Some of the stuff that we started covering has been in blue. And so I put these topics. And as we left off on Thursday, we were talking about property and more specifically land, because this is where they shifted and they started pointing out that the value of land would definitely shift, because when we look at the existing colonies, you know, they'd been established for a couple hundred years, and the prime land, you know, the best land to set up a good sized plantation in these existing colonies was primarily already taken. I mean, people had already come and got all the good land. And so moving westward was the obvious. As a matter of fact, they started seeing the growth of Kentucky. Kentucky and Tennessee and, was it New Hampshire or Vermont? I think it was New Hampshire. I'd have to look up the states and all of that. And, you know, it only takes me a minute to do that. So might as well. So when I look at the original order, it was Vermont that was the first state to be added to the Union. I always mix those two up. Who begot who? As we look at going west, those three states were just natural expansions that have already occurred. They were already noting this, and that was kind of what drove this conversation, because they saw that the other states were going to have a big, or certain states were going to have a big advantage, because the way they were designed, Virginia, the Carolinas, many of these states were going to have a perpetuity all the way across the United States. And then they said, no. We need to cap that off. So they kind of created these boundaries. And it's interesting, they didn't necessarily, because they already had state boundaries and they created territories, because that's what they were trying to ensure, their sovereignty over a speck of land. They knew that they couldn't maintain a state from sea to shining sea, because whoever was occupying in California at that given point in time, they couldn't run them out. So it was their plan to expand that direction. And to be clear here, I want people to understand this, because most people, you know, just thought that it was wrong, or, you know, it was immoral because, you know, the Indians to the west, you know, they considered that their land. The history books, now I don't know if every tribe was that way. I believe the Navajo was one of the very few tribes that actually homesteaded. In other words, that land was theirs. But as this conquest started moving across, now you got to remember that the whole paradigm was set by the laws of nations. So at that point in time, everything was moving westward on the premise that this is the law of the land. And so the only nation, I have to point this out, if you read any book in history of the colonization of the world by Europe that, you know, kind of talks about how this was all done, you'll find that Portugal and Spain were very bloody. They were not very nice conquerors. I mean, they killed and they humiliated and they didn't treat the indigenous people with any dignity at all. And so when we look at how England actually started occupying the land, they really tried, because at this point in time, they became the empire of the world. Now, the one reason why they behaved was because they didn't want the nations of Europe to basically, you know, kind of join forces to take them on. Everybody was really looking for their toehold. So they didn't want to give anybody any reason why, you know, hey, we got to knock them off the, you know, the top of the mountain. We got to challenge them because, you know, they're being tyrannical. Because they were living by the law and watching everybody else doing all of these abominable things, such as the Portugal and Spanish slave trade, they were the ones doing that. And so as we kind of look at this, you know, this progress, when we inherited it, that was the paradigm we actually inherited. It was just the same thing with how slavery was another paradigm that we inherited. But we actually, by the time we started forging the Constitution, it became very clear, because that's why where we are in the notes, we're talking about property and the prevalence of the importance of property and property value because of slaves. This was being articulated very clearly by the southern states, by the two Carolinas and Georgia. And so when we look at this last conversation about bringing new states into the Union to the West, we can clearly see that the supply of good land was very bountiful to the West. And so it would draw people to go and make a claim, because how much did land cost? Back in those days, it was if you could, because that was the paradigm. If you could take a plot of land and make it productive and put, you know, a house on it and actually, you know, reside there after a certain amount of, it's called homesteading, folks. And these types of laws were starting to persist to help cause the expansion of the United States. This is one of the reasons, and this was one of the factors that they used to help bring states into the Union. Why were they so hungry for bringing states into the Union? Because states were taxable. It was about money. I can't say it any other way. I mean, there may have been these other noble causes or what have you, but it really was about money. There was an incentive. And the reason why Wyoming came in without authority was probably because, okay, well, we can start taxing them at least. And which is why they didn't go out there and say, hey, you can't do this. I mean, they literally pulled the rug out from underneath the federal government, because the federal government never gave an enabling act. The only state that didn't get one. And so there's a lot of interesting things and a lot of interesting history about Wyoming. And I'll tell you, it's the least populated state, and it is probably the most marginalized state. But here's the interesting thing. It could be the state that actually leads the reclaiming of the republic. They're great people. But anyway, as we're kind of preparing to dive into this, my point is this, is that we're kind of going through how they were justifying, you know, making this land on the West, or the states that they expanded into, not have the same footing. In other words, they wouldn't get as equal representation. They would have limited representation, but they would pay the equal taxes or what have you. And so, you know, it started coming out, hey, you know, we cannot go after the Western states because there's a lot more land out there. And, you know, if we actually go all the way, and I don't even think they were saying it this way, but my articulation is, if you look at what could happen, you know, these other states could actually overpower and then oppress the Eastern states. It only became logical to treat everybody equally and be fair. You know, the way we build accord and build, you know, mutual respect and a mutual dependency or a symbiotic relationship is through being fair. So this was the paradigm. And that paradigm got lost shortly after the echoes of the words in the Independence Hall, practically. I mean, there were many good men that held on to that. But as those words were being forgotten by those men in the Constitutional Convention, the federal government started exceeding its authority in admitting new states. Just to be clear here, they were putting into the Constitution actual steps that would make the states lesser, taking away their equal sovereignty and so forth. But instead, they mentioned nothing to that, and they gave the federal government no power to diminish their sovereignty. They gave them no power to actually possess any land within a state. As a matter of fact, to the negative, in Article 1, Section 8, subsection, I think it's the necessary and proper clause. Instead of saying, I think, let's just go ahead and go to it. Because it says right here, it's 16, subsection 16, that they can they have this exclusive authority over the seat of the District of Columbia, the seat of government for the federal government. But for them to possess any land within a state, I'm really emphasizing, if I could yell, because I don't want to have to spend a lot of time editing with all the dynamic peaks. Anyway, because I go to a great length in trying to provide the best audio quality for these recordings. And so just that's a sub-reference there. So when we look at what it says here, to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same. So in other words, they have to purchase it from the legislature of the state. So let me ask you this. If the federal government goes out and buys a plot of land, let's just say the Louisiana Territory. Okay, they just bought that. Does that mean that they can own that land? Does that mean that land is theirs? Well, does it say that they purchased that from the states or from the state legislatures? No. They purchased that from another. So it was a treaty, a land treaty within the federal government. Do they have the authority to bring land into the United States? Absolutely. Because if we look at Article 4, that's a responsibility of bringing new states into the union. So as they started bringing new states into the union, here was the point in time. As a matter of fact, if you've read Why Counties Matter Most, I believe this is where I dive into Thomas Jefferson's amendment to be able to give land to Indians. In other words, for the federal government to actually allocate land set aside for Indians. In other words, they had no ability to give land or create a treaty to possess land for them. And everything that they did from Andrew Jackson on was all unconstitutional. Now, I know the first thing everybody wants to hear is reparations, reparations. Their reparations is unconstitutional. So this is why I got to make this important. You've got to understand this. It's this important. Sorry, I'm getting a little excited. The reason why reparations, or actually the reason why keeping government in line with the Constitution, is because there are no reparations. Down the road, when they harm lots of people, because who is that? That's really we the people. It's our fault. And the whole premise of this nation is to get things right, which is why there's this little thing that we have as a responsibility. So in other words, if the federal government is doing bad things and they did something bad, then that goes on to we the people, because we the people have to get our government from the county and state to hold the federal government accountable. Madison and Jefferson gave us that model. They showed us the beauty of using interposition in hold as a parent, interposing upon your child to get them into compliance, using whatever force is necessary. Folks, we don't have to use military force at all. We have the ability to, because our government isn't a bunch of buildings, guns, and everything else. Our government is people. We just have to remove them for their failings. We were given this in the 14th Amendment. So everybody that goes around and says the 14th Amendment is bad, we need to undo that. Are you kidding me? It is the third dot in the cycle of being able to reclaim or restore our government. The oath, the petition, and the holding them accountable to remove them. All three are essential. It's almost like the Godhead, you know, the number three. Anyway, I always see these correlations of religious magnitude. But anywho, so let me dive into where we were, because I think this is so critical that we start understanding this. Now, again, they were talking about Western states, and they were talking about the apportionment and so forth. And now Mr. Gorham starts making more friends with some of his comments, basically says this: Mr. Gorham supported the propriety of establishing numbers as the rule. He said that in Massachusetts, estimates had been taken in the different towns, and that persons had been curious enough to compare these estimates with the respective numbers of the people. It had been found, even including Boston, that most exact proportion prevailed between numbers and property. He was aware that there might be some weight in what had fallen from his colleagues as to the umbrage which might be taken by the people of the eastern states. He recollected that when the proposition of Congress for changing the 8th article of the Confederation was before the legislature of Massachusetts, the only difficulty then was to satisfy them that Negroes ought not to have been counted equally. Whites, instead of being counted in the ratio of 3/5, or equally with whites, I'm sorry. So Mr. Wilson then pipes up and says he did not well see on the principle the admission of blacks in the proportion of 3/5 could be explained. Are they admitted as citizens? No. As a matter of fact, Taney later on says no. Now, I believe that was the underlying truth, because he says this: are they admitted as citizens? Then why are they not admitted on an equality with white citizens? So, we're going to read through this. Is there anybody that contradicts that blacks cannot be citizens and are not citizens? Let's find out. They are admitted as property? Then why is not other property admitted into computation? These were difficulties, however, which he thought must be overruled of the necessity of compromise. He had some apprehensions also from the tendencies of the blending of blacks with whites to give disgust to the people of Pennsylvania, as had been intimated by his colleague, Mr. Governor Morris, but he differed from him in thinking numbers of inhabitants so incorrect a measure of wealth. He had seen the western settlements of Pennsylvania, and on a comparison of them with the city of Philadelphia, could discover little other difference than that property was more unequally divided among individuals. When you read this, and if you read this with me, you're going to notice that the way Madison writes, he actually puts a space, dot, space, space. And so you think that, okay, that's time for a pause, when actually it's not. So forgive me. That's why it was a little bit broken up. He says, then that property was more unequally divided among individuals here than there. Taking the same number of the aggregate into the two situations, he believed there would be little difference in their wealth and ability to contribute to the public wants. Mr. Governor Morris was compelled to declare himself reduced to the dilemma of doing injustice to the southern states are to human nature, and he must therefore do it to the former, to the southern states, for he could never agree to give such encouragement to the slave trade as would be given by allowing them a representation for the Negroes, and he did not believe those states would ever confederate on terms that would be deprived them of that trade. So, on the question of agreeing to include 3/5 of blacks, Massachusetts said no. Connecticut said yay. New Jersey said no. Pennsylvania said no. Delaware said no. Maryland said no. Virginia said yay. North Carolina, South Carolina said yay. And Georgia said yay. So on the question as to taking the census for the first year meeting of the legislature, and so here's the question. Did they actually pass that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 no's, and there were more 6. So agreeing to include 3/5 of blacks. So in other words, the 3/5 rule passed, and it was a very close vote. The next question was taking the census after the first year meeting of the legislature. In other words, to get everything accurate. Because if they could create an unknown advantage, then okay. And I'll tell you what, the way they had to take those censuses, and I'll bet you anything, because they were divided, they were audited. Those censuses were probably done by the federal government, and they were audited and checked. In other words, I'll bet you anything, it was not the Southern. A Southern federal employee that went into the South to count, you know, the slaves and the inhabitants of the property. Does that make sense? In other words, they were so divided on this issue, and this goes to our election. How in the heck did this nation get divided between Democrats and Republicans? You know, are you born a Democrat or Republican? As a matter of fact, it's an ideological thing. I'm going, this is what division is, the devil's tool of destruction. That's all I got to say. But anyway, on the question of the census, Massachusetts said yay. Connecticut said no. New Jersey said yay. Pennsylvania said yay. Delaware said yay. Maryland said no. Virginia said yay. North Carolina said yay. South Carolina said yay. And Georgia said no. So it was 3-7. So the 10 states voting, because I think at this time New York was still unable to vote. So then Mr. Madison moved to add, after the 15 years, the word at least the legislature might anticipate the circumstances likely to render a particular inconvenient on this motion, at least it passed in the negative states being equally divided. And so that was the final kind of conclusion. What I want to do, because they basically end the day, they go into an adjournment after another vote. And so I want to jump down to the next, on Thursday, July 12th, they start talking about property again. And so this is Governor Pinckney, actually General Pinckney, not governor, of South Carolina. And he basically desired that the rule of wealth should be ascertained and not left to the pleasure of the legislature, and that property in slaves should not be exposed to danger under a government instituted for the protection of property. The first clause of the report of the first committee was postponed. Mr. Ellsworth of Connecticut, in order to carry into effect the principle established, moved to add that the last clause adopted by the House, the words following, quote, and the rule of contribution by direct taxation for the support of the government of the United States shall be the number of white inhabitants and 3/5 of every other description in the several states. Now, did that include Indians? Well, I mean, they're talking about the inhabitants of the other states, right? So he goes on and says, until some other rule that shall more accurately ascertain the wealth of the several states can be devised and adopted by the legislature. Now, Mr. Butler piped up and seconded the motion in order that it might be committed. Now, Mr. Randolph is going to say something, but we're going to get to that when we come back. and then it'll go to Mr. Ellsworth and so forth. So, again, they're kind of talking about, you know, this value of land and how slaves are inherent in that in the South. And so that kind of, well, if it doesn't make sense, I'll bring some sense to it when we come right back. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. So why all this fuss about slaves, property, and value? Well, if I haven't said this, if I've not articulated this, I will now. And if, forgive me if I repeat myself. What is the value of those plantations in the South without slaves? Because they've already come out and said they, white people, can't do that work. Or at least I know it has been said several times, and they've justified this. Well, you know, there have been white people that actually have had their own plantations, and they had no slaves in the South. It's a matter that those people were above doing the work. In other words, the elitist attitude of these very few plantation franchise holders, this posterity that had already kind of started rifing itself through the South. Well, they were the ones that had the affluence. They were the ones that were making sure that politically that they were doing everything. Now, at this point in time, they weren't totally evil. They weren't talking about, you know, killing everybody with chemtrails and all of that. It was only about slavery. But I'm just letting you know that there was a clarity that was coming out of the Southern politicians to protect slavery for these large plantation owners, period. And I think the advantage that they had, these were the major corporations. I want you to understand that these were the big corporations of America. Which is where, this is why there was this need to maintain the Southern states because of their wealth. When we look at all the other states, I mean, they were, you know, thriving in enterprise and fact, you know, merchandising and manufacturing, but the real bulk of large masses of money going into very specific hands. I mean, George Washington and Martha, they combined their plantation and their holdings. And, I mean, Washington had his own industry. Now, he was not a fan of slavery, and upon his death, it was something he inherited. And upon his death, he basically put a death warrant on Martha. Anybody that understands where Washington's position was on slavery, because they claim him an evil man, he did everything he could to try to protect his slaves. I hate to say this. He never had. They were his children, and he loved them. He sacrificed. I've said this before. When they were sick or hurt or injured, he tended to them. And when they ran away, he pleaded with them to protect them from being picked up by an evil slave owner. And when he died, he set his slaves free on the condition that Martha would set her slaves free, or they would go free on her death. And instead of, basically it was a death warrant. What he did was he said, my slaves can go free and become free when Martha dies. Well, as soon as they found that out, they go, well, how can we kill Martha? Maybe they didn't like Martha. Well, it kind of forced the issue because she actually set them free. And then I think the Mount Vernon plantation was half what it was worth, or probably even maybe less. I don't know what his contribution was like, but I'm just giving you this real truth that the people that had the money and the large stake in America were those who had a large, you know, body of slaves and large plantations and had large families to actually expand their plantations across the South. So, Mr. Randolph was not satisfied on the motion. The danger would be revived that the ingenuity of the legislature may evade or pervert the rule so as to perpetuate the power where it has been lodged in the first instance. He proposed, in lieu of Mr. Ellsworth's motion, quote, that in order to ascertain the alterations in representation that may be required from time to time by changes in the relative circumstances of the states, a census shall be taken within 2 years from the first meeting of the General Legislature of the United States, and once within every year afterwards of all the inhabitants in the manner according to the ratio recommended by Congress in the resolution of the 18th day of April, 1783, relating the blacks at 3/5 of their number, and that the legislature of the United States shall arrange the representation accordingly, close quote. Now, do you think Mr. Randolph, the governor of Virginia, was defending slavery and helping empower it more? No, he wasn't. He urged strenuously that, I'm moving back to what Madison said, he urged strenuously that express security ought to be provided for including slaves in the ratio of representation. He lamented that such a species of property existed. But as it did exist, the holders of it would require this security. It was so, in other words, he's basically saying that they had to give this compromise, but they didn't deserve full representation, because the way the South was exploiting their very existence. Now, Mr. Ellsworth withdraws his motion and seconds that of Mr. Randolph. Mr. Wilson then observed that less umbrage, you know, less hurt and bad feelings would perhaps be taken against the admission of the slaves into the rule of representation if it should be so expressed as to make them indirectly only an ingredient in the rule by saying that they should never enter into the rule of taxation. In other words, he wanted to kind of make sure that that was how it was going to go down. And as representation was to be according to taxation, the end would be equally attained. He accordingly moved and seconded so to alter the last clause adopted by the House that together the amendment proposed the whole should read as follows, provided that there was the representation ought to be proportioned according to direct taxation, and in order to ascertain alterations in the direct taxation, which may be required from time to time by the changes of the relative circumstances of the states, resolved that a census be taken within 2 years from the first meeting of the legislature of the United States and once within the term of every year afterwards of the inhabitants of the United States, in the manner and according to the ratio recommended by the Congress in their resolution of April 18, 1783, and that the legislature of the United States shall proportion the direct taxation accordingly. And so, they're talking about actually doing a census on a yearly basis, folks. Could you imagine that? I mean, we've gone through census over the past, you know, the beginning of each decade, 2020. And that took so that took a long time to do. They can't. There's no way they could do a census that fast. Unless, and the reason why does it take so long to do a census today? Because they try to gather more information than they have the authority to know. As a matter of fact, when you look at the data that they pull in the census, they don't have any authority to know that. The Constitution demands that they count, you know, how many people, and are they slaves or not? Are they U.S. citizens? That is it. They have no right. Remember the Fourth Amendment? We're to be secure in our persons against giving any information to government unless there's a warrant written by a judge. But we give them all of this data. As long as I've lived, I've never spoken to a census gatherer. I take that back. When I was in the military, I did, and all I told them was the inhabitants of the home. That's it. I had told them, you know, nothing else regarding demographics. And to me, they didn't need to know that. And I know they didn't need to know that. I gave them the citizenship, and that's it. So, Mr. King of Massachusetts, although this amendment varies the aspects somewhat, he had still two powerful objections against tying down the legislature to the rule of the numbers. One, they were at this time uncertain index of the relative wealth of the states. Two, if they were a just index at this time, it can be supposed it always to continue so. He was far from wishing to retain any unjust advantage, whether in one part of the Republic. Now, again, Mr. King's from Massachusetts, and he's kind of wondering if, you know, are they going to be able to keep this forever? If justice was not the basis of the connection, it could not be of long duration. He must be short-sighted, indeed, who does not foresee that when the southern states shall be more numerous than the northern, they can and will hold a language that will awe them into justice. If they threaten to separate, now in a case injury shall be done them, will their threats be less urgent or effectual when force shall be back their demands? Even in the intervening period, there will no point of time, it should be at no point of time, at which they will not be able to say, do us justice or we will separate. He urged the necessity of placing confidence to a certain degree in government and did not conceive that the proposed confidence as to a periodical readjustment of the representation exceeded that degree. Now, I think he just revealed something very interesting, that because the northeastern states were not able to grow. They did not have the ability of perpetuating a franchise moving westward because that they didn't have any territory. They didn't have any extra land. So Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina moved to amend Mr. Randolph's motion so as to make, quote, blacks equal to whites in the ratio of representation, close quote. This, he urged, was nothing more than justice. The blacks are the laborers, the peasants of the South. They are as productive of a pecuniary resource as those of the northern states. They added equally to the wealth and considering, so, I mean, and I'll finish this, and considering money as the sinew of war to the strength of the nation, it will be so politic with regard to the northern states as taxation is to keep pace with representation. And I mean, they're making up and they're continually holding the line that they wanted their slaves to help them maintain their power through representation. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there that the way this was looking, the reason that the three-fifths rule was created was strictly because slavery was, you know, not admired by the majority of the slaves or by the majority of the states, that slavery was considered an abomination by the majority of the states. They wanted to get rid of it. I mean, I mean, I think I'm trying to remember. I believe it was Governor Randolph, the governor of Virginia, basically said he wished it didn't even exist. So there were three states that were trying to drive this. The reason that there was representation given to slaves at all was because the southern states were actually, you know, going to, and we're going to get to this, where they actually say, we're going to leave. And this is when Mason, and I don't know if Madison catches this, but this is when Mason, on August 22nd, where are we on the date? We're basically 40 days away, plus, because we're on July 12th. So we're good 40 days away before this boils up to Mason's curse to this nation. Anyway, General Pinckney moves to insert, instead of two as the period of computing, first meeting with the legislatures within the first census should be taken on the question for inserting six instead of two in the proposition of Mr. Wilson. It passed the affirmative. So in other words, he wanted to expand the changing of representation to every 6 years. And so Massachusetts said no. Connecticut said aye. New Jersey said aye. Pennsylvania said aye. Delaware divided, couldn't vote, and Maryland said aye. Virginia said no. North Carolina said no. South Carolina said aye, and Georgia said no, and it passed. And then Massachusetts, and then on a question for filling the blank for a year periodical census with 20 years, it is passed in the negative. So in other words, it didn't pass at all. On the question of 10 years, it passed in the affirmative. So that's when they finally hammered down that the census would be done every 10 years. Now, they kind of go on and on. And the Mr. Wilson basically, or actually Mr. Randolph requested that Mr. Wilson's, you know, proposition, you know, be read as it was. And basically, Mr. Gary of Massachusetts urged that the principle of it could be carried into execution as the states were not to be taxed as states with regard to taxes in imports. He conceived that it would be more productive where there were no slaves than there were the consumption being greater. In other words, Mr. Gary was basically talking about how they wanted to change the taxation regarding imports, because he was basically saying that it was an advantage to the South because they were exporting more than they would be importing. And where the North, they weren't able to grow the food. And as a matter of fact, here's the interesting thing. Due to slavery in the South, most of the property in the South, because they weren't plantations, because most of the white people didn't own plantations, only the very large popular, it was an elite group. Thomas Sowell notes in Black Rednecks and White Liberals that if you floated down, I believe it was the Ohio River, and some of the whatever the river is that separated that Mason-Dixon line kind of as it traversed towards the Mississippi, you could distinctly see the starved and emaciated cows and the, you know, the poor kept, you know, fields and so forth. You know, it's just a surprise that they could actually produce food and agricultural products. On the other side of the river, there were beautiful fields. They were well kept. And there was no slavery. And so the question is, why? And as a matter of fact, if you actually look at the production of butter in these days, you would find that there, even though there were less cows in the North was producing more butter than the South. In other words, the people that were having the advantage, they kept the advantage in the South. And the rest of the people were allowing it because they were indoctrinated to, you know, to live and die and support their slavery. And, you know, I think that this is when people really started waking up. That's why Thomas Sowell points out that the majority of the people of the South at the time of the Civil War, the majority of the people were against it. It was only the elitist who had the power, who was controlling the government of these states, to get them to declare and to declare the secession, to move out of the Union so that they could preserve slavery. And that's how they basically, instead of actually declaring war and trying to overtake the North, because they knew if they did that, they would probably lose because the North would want to defend. But because they seceded, they actually had there had to be a real cause for the North to come after them. And Lincoln was the tyrant to violate the law and violate the Constitution to do that. However, and I've said this before, Lincoln had, under the Monroe Doctrine, the ability to actually end foreign influence. And the first thing that the South started doing was they started up the slave trade. This is where Lincoln could have actually declared the end of slavery in the northern or the Western Hemisphere, and that they were going to start with the South. That would have kept them from dying for 2 years, not winning a battle, and that would have got the North, who were nothing but abolitionists, engaged and invigorated to fight that war. But instead, they all dragged their feet, which has forced Lincoln. I think all of this happened because this was let me just continue saying what I was going to say. This is why Lincoln could not mobilize the militia and violated the Constitution in fighting the war by using a standing army. He established an army instead of federalizing the militia, which is what he was required by the law to do. He stepped away from the Constitution. He stepped away from the Constitution in so many different ways. And so why and how? I'll let you all speculate because there's lots of different theories of who Lincoln was, what he was, and so forth. All I can tell you is he was a tyrant. He violated the Constitution, and getting these things right is critical. This is why I provided you the constitutional presidential perspective, what a true constitutional president could do for this nation. I'm telling you. If we want to heal this nation, it's going to come on the foundation of the Constitution, period. So, Mr. Gary, we just covered that. So, Mr. Ellsworth, in case of a poll tax, there would be no difficulty, but there would be probably none. The sum allotted to the states may be levied without difficulty according to the plan used by the state in raising its own supplies on the question. And this is basically talk about some nuances regarding taxation and so forth. And so as far as I'm concerned, I think it's, kind of moot to cover it in any further. So the next step, and we got 6 minutes, we've got later on, July 13th, they're talking about property again. Finding the loss of the question had proceeded from an objection with some to the proposed assessment of direct taxes on the inhabitants of the states, which might restrain the legislature to poll tax, moved his proposition again to a poll tax, moved his proposition again, but so varied as to authorize the assessment of the states, which would leave the mode to the legislature at this caret, insert the words interlined, viz., or quote, that from the first meeting of the legislature of the U.S. until a census shall be taken, all monies for supplying the public treasury by direct taxation will be raised from the said several states according to the number of the representatives in the first branch. On this very question, it passed in the affirmative. And so on the motion of Mr. Randolph, the vote of Saturday last authorizing the legislature to adjust from time to time the representation upon the principles of wealth and numbers of inhabitants was reconsidered by common consent in order to strike out wealth and adjust the resolution that requiring periodically. So just to be clear here, they were actually looking at taxation on wealth. In other words, the wealthier you were, the more tax you would pay. Focused on, because it's not about income, it's about your wealth. And so that's kind of interesting if you really look at it, because this was kind of an insidious taxation that they were trying to impose. And it was Randolph that basically went after it. Anyway, strike out wealth and adjust the resolution that required periodical revisions according to the number of whites and 3/5 blacks. The motion was in the following, quote, "But as the present situation of the states may probably alter in the number of their inhabitants, the legislature of the U.S. be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives in case any of the states shall hereafter divide, or any two states united, or new states created within the limits of the United States, the legislature of the United States shall propose authority to regulate the number of representatives of any of the foregoing cases upon the principle of their number and inhabitants according to the provision hereafter mentioned." So there's a few things he added here. One of the things he added was that the Congress would have the ability to control the apportionment or that number of people to representation. And so as we kind of go through this more, Mr. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania then states, he says, opposed the alteration as leaving still an incoherence. If Negroes were to be viewed as inhabitants and the revision was to proceed on the principle of numbers of inhabitants, they ought to be added in their entire number and not in the proportion of 3/5. Now, let me just add this. Why was the South so adamant in maintaining the slave trade for 20 years? Because every slave that came into the South was now counted as 3/5. And the more they could get, the more representation they could get. And so they kept on justifying, we need more, we need more. And I'm here to tell you that there's no doubt in my mind that the plantation owners actually started importing young black women and men so that they could have very, you know, young, so that they could start producing more and more and more. And so they probably went out of their way to, you know, couple them together so that they could start producing children. And so that those children could be then taken from their families and sold or given to the other plantations and so forth. I mean, you're talking about just a godless, heartless group of people doing this to human beings. The evil was being perpetuated in America until that Civil War. Now, Mr. Morris goes on and says, if as property the word wealth was right and striking it out would produce the inconsistency which it was meant to get rid of. The train of business and the late turn which it had taken had led him to say, into deep mediation on it, and he would candidly state the result. A distinction had been set up, urged between the North and the South states. He said, hitherto considered the doctrine is heretical. In other words, bad. It's heretical. It's you know, godless. He still thought the distinction groundless. He sees, however, that it is persisted in, and that the South, gentlemen will not be satisfied unless they see the way open to gaining a majority of the public councils. Okay, so we're going to end there. So what I'm going to do tomorrow is I'm going to pick it right up from Governor Morris, kind of basically coming back after what Mr. Gary had said. And so we'll be right back tomorrow with more of the notes on the Constitutional Convention. Madison's Notes. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.